Welcome back to Taking Flight. Social media, in my opinion, can be seen as a paradox. It has brought the world closer together, but at the same time, it has also created feelings of isolation within society. By constantly viewing the personal lives of others, we often undermine our own accomplishments by comparing ourselves to them. Our mindless scrolling through our phones have taken over our lives, changing the wiring of our brains to have shorter attention spans and crave immediate gratification. Now, I have no authority to criticize this topic. I myself spend around 2 to 3 hours a day on average on Facebook. Sometimes I don't even know what I'm looking at. Social media clearly has its benefits, though. It can allow for a wide array of exposure in a short period of time. This has proven to be especially useful when showcasing sightings of rare species. For example, the arrival of a snowy owl just a few weeks ago in Central Park attracted swarms of people to the area, making the owl reach celebrity status. Sharing information about birds has always been a custom ritual for birding, but nowadays it has become instantaneous. All of this exposure can also be detrimental, for the bird anyway. Social media exposes the species as well as their location, making them vulnerable to hunters who come across the post. A hunter doesn't even have to physically shoot the bird to cause it harm. Birds can be stressed out emotionally by the unwanted paparazzi. Honestly, we would do anything to get a high-quality photograph of a rare bird species. When I was young, I would almost always get too close to a bird or mammal. What I didn't know back then was that by being at arm's length to a deer or bird or squirrel or you name it, I was causing them emotional harm. Imagine if a swarm of complete strangers barged into your home unexpectedly within a few minutes. You probably wouldn't be very happy, rather you would probably have a panic attack. This leads me to the controversial debate as to whether the usage of social media has helped or hindered wildlife conservation. Though the main focus of this podcast series are birds, as I mentioned in my first episode, this particular episode will be a bit broad in scope and cover the effect of social media on wildlife conservation in general. Other than catapulting rare species to stardom, social media, if used properly, can help towards the conservation of a species, as if that information wasn't obvious enough already. Social media can also help to determine the popularity of a certain conservation site. Now, this popularity can also serve as a double-edged sword. It can mean more money and awareness of threats facing certain species. For example, if word gets out on social media that a certain conservation site is home to a rare, colorful bird species, or better yet, a giant panda, more money through donations will be directed toward that site. But as mentioned before, social media can also make species more prone to human disturbance by giving hunters or birders access to that particular conservation site. Twitter is one branch of social media that has allowed for massive distribution of ideas in conservation beyond the scope of a wildlife conference or classroom. It has the capability to turn a wildlife conference into a truly global event. For example, during the 2011 International Congress for Conservation Biology meeting in New Zealand, there were over 1,700 related tweets with the official hashtag ICCB. Fewer than 10% of the tweeters were physically present at the meeting, showing an ideal example of a global digital conference facilitated by Twitter. Twitter continued to be influential at the 2013 conference in Baltimore, Maryland, with an 85% increase in the tweets being sent in comparison to 2011. One tweet was even retweeted 427 times. People who were simply attendees of the conference and not participants could also interact with speakers. Their questions would then be sent back to the general audience. This supports my previous statement of spreading information without boundaries. Twitter's unique feature forces users to provide clear, concise information about their research. That, I think, is one of the hardest aspects of science communication. You need to find that perfect balance between converting scientific jargon into something understandable to the common man, without losing the key points of the study or topic. This is a great segue into my next subtopic in this podcast, environmental writing and communication. Environmental writing, as its name suggests, is writing that focuses on environmental topics. This podcast script, for example, is a form of environmental writing. Some environmental writers create news articles for blogs and magazines. There are different branches of environmental writing, such as environmental technical writing, environmental journalism, and environmental fiction, which encompasses the formats poetry, novels, etc. To help us get a better understanding of the topic of environmental writing and communication, I have with me today an environmental writing professor from the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, which just so happens to be the university I completed my bachelor's in. The professor I will be talking to, Elizabeth Hogan, completed her bachelor's at Syracuse University in English and Textual Studies, and her master's in creative writing with a concentration in poetry at the University of Alabama. Since August 2004, she has been an instructor at SUNY ESF, teaching various courses such as Writing and the Environment, Literature of Nature, and Communication in the Sciences, all of which I was a student in. I am very fortunate to have the opportunity of speaking with her today.
Hello!
Hi, how are
you?
Yes. How are you?
I'm
great.
Good. So good to hear your voice. Just interesting work. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Exciting to hear that you're doing this podcast. So tell me, what else has been going on with you? How are you in general?
I'm doing great. Right now, from next week, I'm apparently supposed to go to Florida to work as a technician with grasshopper sparrows under the Florida Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Cool.
I haven't gotten ready yet, but that's a different story.
Yeah, are you in New York right now?
Yeah, I'm in New York right now.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. So you got to pack up and leave, kind
mm-hmm,
of,
yeah.
Not a lot of time, prep time.
Mm-hmm,
gotcha.
Yep, and I'll be staying there the whole summer, so.
Yeah, that's great. I'm so glad to hear that, you've got, or I know right now, too, a lot of conservation positions are hard to come by from what I've heard from former students.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Yeah. I just read a really interesting piece. Did you read the piece in Audubon about, what do we do with Audubon now that we know a lot more about?
I don't think so. I didn't get around to it.
Do you know, the work of Drew, is it Lanham?
His name sounds familiar.
He's the one that wrote, he has a memoir, but he also kind of got popular because he wrote that 9 rules for black birders that was on Orion.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, so this piece just came out in the current Audubon magazine, and it kind of blew me away. I mean, I had no idea. I didn't really know much about Audubon's background, and really disconcerting. And he's writing about it as someone who dressed up as a child, as Audubon for Halloween. Was a huge lifelong fan, and is a he teaches at Clemson, I think.
Okay.
I'm sure he's still there, but he's in ornithology. Conservation, but he specialized in ornithology, obviously, and really great writer, first of all. But this essay is really moving, and it's painful, to think about what happens when we find out these heroes. And I know, I was just, as I teach these early, I'm at the beginning of the 390 course I teach, and I'm teaching all the sort of writers from the 19th century and the stories of just their personal politics. You're like, oh my gosh. how do we need to focus on social media, but I think maybe on environmental issues and or wildlife conservation, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But here's what I'm going to suggest to you, and could sort of speak off the top of my head, just sort of general as an observer of culture, but not from any position of expertise. And the things I was thinking about is just the citizen science that we can do, the geotagging, the crowdsourcing, right? And the heightened sort of public awareness of certain issues, right? These are all things that I think we can point to very specific examples and say, look how we've been able to accomplish a lot, especially when it comes to that data sharing, that citizen science portion. I think that's so, there's concrete, quantitative data on that. I also think there's, there are certain drawbacks. Every time we're on social media, we're essentially saturated in this environment that's all about consumption, right? These sites, Facebook, Instagram now. It used to not be, but now, you know, they're driven by ads. Those are all driven by advertisements. And I think we're getting bombarded. And so I think there's a way in which, you know, the general thrust of a lot of social media is undermined by its very, you know, funding sources, right? So I think, you know, there's things like that that I could speak of, but I think the other problem is that we often get half pictures. Right? I think about how science is
very
often,
one-sided.
Kind of cherry picked, right? I think back to when we would talk in our class about the kind of studies that got sort of media attention or even got published in scholarly publications, right? They're usually the ones with the big surprising results, often because they're not correct sometimes in some cases, or because they're outliers, right? Some, and sometimes, you know, I think we've gotten better about that, but I think, you know, that can be problematic. I think the way the broader media sort of cherry picks which studies to highlight. So, I mean, these are all things I think that you could talk about or focus on, but I feel like, right, because I'm an instructor at a college, you know, but I'm a part-time instructor. I don't have, my background's in creative is twofold. The first one is, I mentioned Tyler Dorhall. He has been at ESF now for 2 or 3 years. Exciting, especially, I mean, I think about my sister, right? Because I'm not an academic, right? But my sister is, and she, you know, she wrote a book about, you know, utopian texts from, you know, 16th and 17th century England. You know, not a lot of people ask her about that. If someone called her and said, hey, I'm doing, you know, a podcast on this, she would be like, awesome. What do you want to ask me? Go ahead. So I really think that if you reach out to someone and say, hey, I do a podcast, Recruiter Bex Radio, it's called Taking Flight. I'm interested in doing an episode on this, and I saw your paper on XYZ, and I'd really love to talk to you, you know, about that for the show. If you know, you're amenable, if you have any time, let me know. Right? I think people would actually be thrilled to talk about that. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I just have a few questions. So, like, when initially, as I mentioned before, this was on the social media and its impact on wildlife conservation. But then I realized I should stretch it out a little bit, and I made a segue from social media into the topic of environmental writing and communication.
I mean, the one thing I would say is that's a pretty broad topic. If you do want to do environmental writing more broadly, I think talking to, were you in class when, what's Hillary's last name? I gotta look it up. We had a environmental writer, an environmental journalist come to class. Do you remember that?
Oh yeah, that was in, I think, like November of freshman year, right?
I think it was in the spring.
Or was it in the spring?
I think it was in the
Was it in the communications course?
Yeah, it was in the communications. Okay. Yeah. And so, I mean, I think you could talk to someone like that. But I think you need to talk to someone who does the actual writing. That's what I would say.
Okay, well, I have some questions just on, like, I guess your environmental writing teaching and courses. Would you mind if I asked you some of that?
Sure.
Okay, so I guess the first question is very broad, and you've probably heard this before many times. What inspired you to come into your field?
Accident. Honestly, I ended up teaching basic communication courses at ESF, and once I was here, I found this really engaged, interesting community that was doing incredible work. I learned from my students, I learned from my colleagues, and that drove my interest. And as I began reading more environmental literature, nature literature, it opened up possibilities for me teaching other courses. And when I started teaching the lit class in particular, mm-hmm. that's when I think I kind of found my niche. But it was honestly a happy accident. And part of that is because when I was going to school, there weren't very many courses about environmental literature or even environmental communication at the time. You know, because okay. I'm a creative writer mm-hmm. and not someone who is studying this as a social scientist, for instance, when I was coming of age and I was in college, you know, the field of eco-criticism was just beginning. That term was coined by Cheryl Gottfleppi in, I think it was 1990, right? So I was a college student in the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. You know, there weren't courses yet designed around this. Right. Maybe some specialized courses in very particular universities who were driving this new field. But there weren't at Syracuse University where I was a student. Mm-hmm. And even when I was at University of Alabama, you know, we read sort of regional writers and maybe talked a little bit about the role of landscape, but we weren't looking at these texts from an eco-critical perspective. And so that was something that I think a lot of people who now teach these courses, mm-hmm. even, you know, we don't have necessarily a formal background in eco-criticism. We are coming at it having learned about it mm-hmm. as the field and as ASLE, the Association for the Study of Environment and Literature, you know, came about. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Okay, yes, that makes sense.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the next generation of people teaching these courses will actually have the benefit of having taken mm-hmm. these kinds of courses mm-hmm. and, you know, have their dissertations on these topics. And there certainly have been people who have chosen that, individual writers who've done that. But in terms of like programs of study, it's still a really new field.
Yeah, it is. And it's constantly evolving.
That's right.
So initially, as I mentioned, like I was thinking of maybe just having this podcast talk about some experiences of an environmental writing instructor, because that's essentially a form of communication. You're just like educating the younger generation of students.
Sure, yeah.
So please forgive me. I forgot the answer to this question, even though we mentioned it 1,000 times in class. But how does environmental writing differ from nature writing? And do you have any examples? I know we talked about this many times.
This is a great, I think this is something that you'll get different answers from depending on who you talk to, mm-hmm. right? And I think typically when we think nature writing, most of us think of a kind of writing where absolutely nature is a primary focus, mm-hmm. but often it's about appreciating the natural world. It's about making observation, and it doesn't necessarily have a critical aspect or an argumentative aspect. And I think Bill McKibben has mm-hmm, a really right. fantastic definition of environmental writing in the beginning of his anthology, American Earth. And in that, he talks about environmental writing as being more than nature writing, in that it talks about the collision of sort of human life and behavior and the natural world. And I think that's a really important distinction that he's making. You could also look at someone like Lawrence Buell, who is one of the founders of eco-criticism, essentially, who talks about sort of different criteria. He has 4 criteria for environmentally oriented literature. That's the term mm-hmm. he uses.
Right.
And so I think, and that criteria is really specific, but asks us to look at important things. You know, I'm trying to think of the language that he uses. Is there an interest beyond the human that's considered in the text, right? Are we thinking about non-human nature as having an interest or a stake in the world? Does the text show human accountability to the environment? Does the text show nature as something that is dynamic and evolving and changing, or is it something static? And of course, you know, is nature something that's given a front seat? Is it more than I think he uses the term framing device for mm-hmm. the story or the essay or the poem? And I think those are all really helpful for just pushing us to examine the text in critical ways.
Okay. So what you're saying is environmental writing focuses more on like the static
nature. It's more than just celebration. It's looking at the problems that have taken place. It's thinking very carefully about the environmental ideologies that are being suggested through the text. So something like, is it a biocentric text? I think a lot of things that we classify as nature writing are actually pretty anthropocentric at times, right? It's about my journey, my spiritual journey through this location and place. And the nature is important because it gives me a sort of place to be. But I value it in a general way versus are we thinking about the natural world in a more ecocentric or biocentric way beyond interests of the human.
So I'm just thinking aloud. So the works of Thoreau and Emerson that we read, would fall in the category of environmental writing then, right? Not nature writing?
I think it really depends on the piece that you're talking about.
Okay.
And I think there are ways in which, you know, a lot of people have noted that a text like Emerson's Nature doesn't have a whole lot of nature in it.
Right.
The primary point of that text is philosophical.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some really beautiful moments, right? When Emerson talks about being a transparent eyeball in that text, mm-hmm. and being part of this universe that is bigger, right? I think that's a moment that we might see as something that pushes that text into that environmental realm in a way, right? He's recognizing his smallness and the connectedness that he has to the rest of the world. But at the same time, I think the general thrust of the piece has a lot of anthropocentric, you know, hey, what's my spiritual take here?
Yeah.
What am I getting out of this? Why am I going into nature and going out into nature to have this experience?
Right.
You know, and I even think within Thoreau's Walden, then the beginning of that text, I would have a hard time calling much of that environmental. But then you get to a later chapter like Spring, where he's examining how the ice melts, and he's looking at the sludge, the sort of the mud and the forms that it takes.
Mm-hmm.
That is something that is so interesting and attentive. And I have to say, you know, that's not, I shouldn't suggest that there's no environmental attributes to the early parts of the text, right? Talking about moving away from materialism is really important and absolutely environmental too. But I do think that text becomes, I think, more engaged with the real stuff, what he would call the hard bottom of the natural world, you know, as it moves on. So I think, you know, some of those early writers were asking them to think about environmental issues often as readers, the way we think of them now in a time. And Thoreau was noting things like he was making observations about the deforestation that was taking place in the mid 1800s, right? Mm-hmm. He was talking about that. So he was very aware, and he'd read Perkins. He was aware of the environmental destruction that we were causing. But it was a pretty early and evident kind of destruction, right? I think sometimes we ask those writers to be held to the same standards that we would hold a writer now, you know? And I think that's not always fair because the conditions on the ground were very different.
They're writing in a different like time frame, so.
Yeah.
And I remember, I remember in the Walden book, he mentioned like the deforestation of trees like surrounding him,
or
I think he talked
right
about
across the pond.
Right. He was looking across the pond at all the bare branches and stuff, and he made a comparison about that.
Yeah.
And this is, I guess, the final question.
Sure.
I remember in the communication and sciences course, we read a book called "Ignorance and How It Fuels Science" or "Ignorance and How It Drives Science." I guess this is a personal opinion-based question, but what do you think contributes to society's ignorance toward the scientific field?
Oh, I wish I knew. Something we see a lot of.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I think it has to do with the fact that we are looking at red feeds and blue feeds.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I think part of it has to do with these sort of silos of, you know, like-minded people, these echo chambers that we're mm-hmm. all part of, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I am looking at very different information than some of my friends.
Right.
And so I think the sources we go to, who we trust, and I also think some of it has to do with just scientific literacy. Mm-hmm. Do we know how to read a study? You know, what do we, you know, do we understand how a study with 20 participants is not the same thing as a study with a sample that's 10 times that is? Mm-hmm. I mean, I think a lot of times people don't even know to look for that information. They don't think about whether or not they should look at a study and see whether the participants are self-selected or not.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can also skew things in our presentation. I think sometimes that does happen for the dramatic effect.
Yeah.
And I think that that can sometimes misrepresent issues. If something is not an overwhelming statistic, it's not going to catch our attention. I keep seeing people posting things about masks not working, and I can't understand where that's coming from, because number one, I've seen study after study, and they all confirm that they are working. Not only that, my husband works in a hospital and has, you know, we're often with COVID patients and has, you know, been completely safe because of those, you know, that PPE.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of astonished every time I see someone post about this, because that is something that is so clear. And so something that's a little murkier, I think, how are people going to be convinced of these other more nuanced scientific discoveries if they can't be convinced of something that's so clear cut? I don't know. And I think it has to do with who we're listening to and mm-hmm. the political interests of those parties often. I think I would love to say that science isn't political. But in reality, we live in a world where it's been politicized.
Yeah.
So I think that makes it very difficult sometimes to convince people of what the studies are saying when they feel like the organizations that fund those are biased, when they don't like the person who's been the first to voice that, when they don't like the publications that have decided to bring that to the table because they do feel that is important information, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I think it makes it very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And I also feel like it's easier to just state a fact without just fact-checking it at all.
Right.
And that's primarily what contributes, because it's just easier to say, oh, I know this, than to actually do the work and find the research, whether it's right or not.
Yep.
Well, okay, those are all the questions I had. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about environmental communication.
Oh, it was so nice to catch up with you. Can I ask, are you going to call, try to reach out to Tyler? Should I send him a message and say, mm-hmm. yeah, that's good. I know a lot of people don't do Facebook anymore either.
Yeah,
so.
I feel really ancient now. I'm thinking of switching over.
Yeah. Are you already feeling that way? I know, it's like, you say Facebook and students' eyes gloss over now.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know. What's that? We're on TikTok.
Yeah.
I think too, one of the things if you decide to write specifically about social media, mm-hmm. I think that would be really interesting to go and look at, like on TikTok, if you look up for the tags, like wildlife conservation, what comes up?
I haven't looked at that. I'm really interested about that now.
Yeah. I think that would be, and is there differences between what the different sort of platforms and the different, and I think that might be really interesting to look at the primary text too. I think that's the kind of stuff that might be more interesting, ultimately. So, okay. I'm sorry I couldn't be more helpful. I just had a lot of...
You gave some very useful inferences about your field, so...
All right. Well, hey, it's really good to hear from you. And I hope you have a good transition to Florida and have a great experience down there. I hope we get to see some of your you know, pictures and experiences online. But I'll also send a heads up to Tyler and just say, hey, one of my former students is talking about doing a podcast on this, and he might reach out to you. So. All right.
And just one last question, like, if you don't mind, could I use this recording for a future episode, if that's okay with you?
I'm just worried because I was kind of just talking. I didn't know that we were going to be talking about that. So I wonder if you wanted to. I don't know if I would stand by that. But everything else, I think, is pretty fair and accurate.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Great. Well. All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth Hogan, for taking the time to share your insight with us. Next week, I will be talking about piping plover conservation, only on Taking Flight.